Here's a statistic that honestly stops you in your tracks. Cardiovascular diseases. They cause almost half, think about that, nearly 45% of all deaths from non-communicable diseases globally.
That's a huge number, and it comes straight from the World Heart Federation. It really sets the stage for why we're talking about atorvastatin today.
Exactly. You probably know it better as Lipitor. That's the brand name Pfizer launched way back in 1997. It's one of those drugs that truly changed the game in managing heart disease risk.
It really did. And think about the scale. CDC data suggests almost 38% of adults right here in the U.S. have high cholesterol. So this isn't some niche topic.
Not at all. It's incredibly relevant for, well, potentially millions listening right now.
Yeah.
And our goal today is simple. Give you a solid, thorough understanding of atorvastatin.
But without making your head spin with, you know, overly dense science speak.
Right. We want this to be your quick, comprehensive guide. We're going to look at where it came from, how it actually works inside your body, its impact health-wise, economically, and some of the really interesting stories behind it all.
It's a great lens, actually. Looking at one drug like atorvastatin tells you so much about how medicines are developed, used, regulated, the whole life cycle.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. Before atorvastatin, before statins even, there was cholesterol itself. And figuring that out took a while.
Oh, definitely. The story goes way, way back, 1784, believe it or not. A French chemist and physician, François Poulenquier, he was the first to isolate it.
And he found it in gallstones, right? Kind of an unusual place to discover something so vital.
It is, isn't it? Then another Frenchman, Michel Chevreul, gave it the name cholesterin a bit later. Comes from the Greek for bile and solid. Makes sense, given where Poutier found it.
But just finding it and naming it isn't the same as understanding it.
Not at all. That took more time. It wasn't until 1888 that Friedrich Ramonitzer, an Austrian botanist, figured out its actual molecular formula and then cracking its structure, that distinctive four-ring structure. That was a huge focus in the early 20th century.
So huge it led to Nobel Prizes.
Two of them. For chemistry. Heinrich Wieland in 1927 and Adolf Windaus in 1928. That really tells you how scientifically important cholesterol was, even back then.
It wasn't just some random discovery. Scientists were deeply fascinated by this molecule for a long time.
Precisely. And all that fundamental research, that deep understanding, it laid the groundwork. It's why scientists eventually started looking for ways to manage cholesterol levels therapeutically.
Which brings us finally to the statins. How did we get from understanding cholesterol to actually having drugs to lower it?
The big leap was in the 1970s. Researchers at a Japanese company, Sankyo, discovered a compound they called compactin.
And this was the first real glimmer of a cholesterol-lowering drug.
It was. They saw its potential. Interestingly, around the same time, Beecham Pharmaceuticals over in the UK, they're part of GSK, now also found compactin.
A parallel discovery. That happens sometimes in science.
It does. But Beecham was initially looking at it as an antifungal, and they ran into a bit of a snag.
What was that?
They couldn't reliably show it lowered cholesterol in rats, which was a standard animal model they were using. Sankyo, using different models, did see the cholesterol-lowering effect more clearly. It shows how crucial those early research choices can be.
So Beecham kind of missed the boat on the cholesterol angle initially, but the story gets even more interesting, doesn't it? There was some early human testing.
Yes, and it was technically unsanctioned. In 1978, a researcher teamed up with a doctor at Osaka University Hospital. They gave compactin to an 18-year-old woman who had a severe genetic condition, familial hypercholesterolemia. Her levels were incredibly high, like 1,000 mgdl.
Wow. And did it work?
It did bring her levels down significantly to around 700 mgdl, which is still high, but a big drop.
But there were problems.
There were. After a few weeks, she developed elevated liver enzymes, some muscle issues, symptoms consistent with muscular dystrophy, actually.
Well, that sounds serious.
It was, but thankfully, the effects reversed when they stopped the drug. Later, lower doses did show some benefit in reducing cholesterol deposits over the long term, even if the initial big drop wasn't sustained quite as hoped.
So a bumpy start, but the potential was clearly there. Enough potential to get other companies interested.
Absolutely. Merck, the big American pharmaceutical company, was definitely paying attention. The results with compactin, especially in the animal studies, were promising enough for them to jump in.
How did they get involved?
They set up a confidentiality agreement with Sankyo in 1976, got samples of compactin, access to Sankyo's data.
A bit of collaboration mixed with competition then?
You could say that. Merck confirmed Sankyo's results, were apparently quite impressed, and then started their own hunt for similar compounds.
And they found one.
They did. In 1979, a team led by Alfred Albert isolated levistatin, also called mevinolin from a fungus, Aspergillus tereus.
And the key thing was?
It was structurally very similar to compactin. Basically, they'd independently found another compound that worked in the same way, that really solidified the idea that this class of drugs had huge therapeutic potential.
Okay, so we have compactin, then levistatin, and then comes the star of our show today. Atorvastatin.
Right. Atorvastatin was the next big step, launched by Pfizer in 1997. It built on everything learned from those earlier statins.
Its chemical name is a mouthful, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. RRR2,4-fluorophenyl, dihydroxy 5,1-methylethyl,3-phenyl,4-phenylamino, carbonyl 1-H pyrrole 1 heptanoic acid calcium salt, 2.1. You don't need to remember that.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
But Pfizer didn't just discover the molecule. They also figured out how to make it efficiently, right?
That was crucial. Large-scale manufacturing is key for any blockbuster drug. They developed an improved synthesis method.
How much better was it?
Significantly. The older methods had yields around, say, 52%. Pfizer's process bumped that up to about 67%. That kind of improvement makes a massive difference in terms of costs and being able to supply the drug globally.
Makes total sense. Okay, we've got the history down. Now let's dig into the how. How does atorvastatin actually lower cholesterol in the body?
Okay, so this is the mechanism of action. Atorvastatin is what we call a selective competitive inhibitor.
Inhibitor of what?
Of an enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase. Now, this enzyme is really important because it controls a key step, the rate-limiting step, actually in the pathway your body uses to make its own cholesterol, primarily in the liver.
So atorvastatin basically puts the brakes on the body's internal cholesterol production line.
That's a great way to put it. It blocks that enzyme. Now, when the liver senses it's making less cholesterol internally, it does something clever.
What's that?
It increases the number of LDL receptors on its surface. LDL cholesterol is often called the bad cholesterol.
Ah, so the liver gets better at grabbing the LDL cholesterol that's already floating around in the blood.
Exactly. More receptors mean more LDL gets pulled out of circulation, taken up by the liver. And the net result is lower levels of LDL cholesterol in your plasma. That's the main goal.
Clever mechanism. Very targeted. So who typically gets prescribed atorvastatin? What are the main reasons?
It's approved for several things. First, primary hyperlipidemia. That's just the general term for high cholesterol.
Go.
Then there's familial hypercholesterolemia, both the homozygous and heterozygous types. These are the genetic forms where people have very high cholesterol from a young age. Atorvastatin is used in adults and kids down to age 10 for this.
So common high cholesterol and specific genetic types.
Right. And then, critically, it's used as an addition to diet changes to reduce the risk of cardiovascular events, heart attacks, strokes.
In which groups of people?
Several key groups. Adults who don't have heart disease yet but have multiple risk factors like high blood pressure, smoking, family history. Also, people with type 2 diabetes who have risk factors. And, very importantly, people who already have established coronary heart disease.
And do medical guidelines offer specific advice on using it, like from the cardiology groups?
They do. The 2018 American College of Cardiology guidelines, for example, have strong recommendations. For adults aged 20 to 75 with really high LDL, 190 mg/dL or more, they recommend using the maximally tolerated dose of a statin.
The highest dose someone can handle without significant side effects.
Exactly. Because that LDL level signifies a very high risk.
What if the statin alone isn't enough for those high-risk people?
Good question. The guidelines suggest that if you don't get at least a 50% drop in LDL on the max statin dose, or if your LDL stays above 100 mg/dL, then adding another drug, ezetimibe, should be considered. It's often about combination therapy for the toughest cases.
You mentioned different forms earlier. There's an oral suspension, Adravalicue.
Yes, Adravalicue. It's a liquid form. And the interesting thing with that one is the specific instruction to take it on an empty stomach.
Why is that?
Because food, especially meals high in fat, can really decrease how much of the drug gets absorbed from the suspension form. So they recommend taking it either an hour before you eat or 2 hours after.
That's a practical detail patients need to know. Okay, let's get a bit more technical pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. How the body handles the drug? What's the usual dose range?
Typically, it's taken once daily, anywhere from 10 milligrams up to 80 milligrams. But the general advice is always to use the lowest effective dose.
And you need more caution with higher doses.
Yes, doses above 20 milligrams generally warrant a bit more care and monitoring. Now, several things can affect how your body processes atorvastatin.
Like what? Kidney function.
Kidney function is interesting. Having impaired kidneys is a risk factor for muscle side effects, myopathy. But surprisingly, it doesn't really change the levels of atorvastatin in the blood much. So usually no dose adjustment is needed just for kidney function, but you definitely need closer monitoring for muscle symptoms.
Okay, what about the liver, since that's where it primarily works?
Ah, the liver is a different story. Liver impairment can dramatically increase atorvastatin levels.
How dramatic.
In people with chronic alcoholic liver disease, for instance, levels can be 4 times higher with mild disease and potentially 11 to even 16 times higher with more severe, like Child's Pugh cirrhosis.
Wow, that's huge.
It is, which is why atorvastatin is actually contraindicated, meaning you absolutely shouldn't use it in patients with active, severe liver failure or decompensated cirrhosis. And you have to use it very cautiously in anyone who drinks a lot of alcohol or has a history of liver disease.
Critical safety point. Any other patient factors? Age, gender.
Yep. Older people tend to have somewhat higher plasma concentrations. There are also slight differences between men and women. Women might have slightly higher peak levels and overall exposure, but it generally doesn't seem to make a clinically meaningful difference in how much their LDL cholesterol is lowered.
And food. You
Right.
mentioned it for atrial VLAQ.
Right. For the suspension, high-fat meals significantly cut down absorption. For the tablets, food can decrease the rate of absorption slightly, but maybe not the overall extent as much. Still, that empty stomach rule for atrial VLAQ is important.
Got it. How does the body actually break down atorvastatin?
It's extensively metabolized, mostly in the liver, by a specific enzyme system called cytochrome P450-3A4, or CYT3A4 for short.
And that metabolism process is important.
Very. It actually creates active metabolites byproducts that also have cholesterol-lowering activity. In fact, these metabolites are thought to account for about 70% of the drug's total inhibitory effect on that HMG-CoA reductase enzyme.
And whenever you hear about enzymes like CYP3A4, you immediately think about
Drug interactions, exactly, because so many other drugs are also metabolized by or affect CYP3A4.
So what are the key interactions to watch out for with atorvastatin?
Well, drugs that strongly inhibit CYP3A4 can significantly increase atorvastatin levels, raising the risk of muscle problems, myopathy, or even rhabdomyolysis.
Like which drugs?
Things like the antibiotic clarithromycin, certain antifungal drugs like Jaconazole, some HIV protease inhibitors. Using these with atorvastatin requires caution, maybe lower doses, or sometimes avoiding the combination altogether. Also, drugs like cyclosporine or gemfibrozil increase the risk through other mechanisms too, and combining them with atorvastatin is generally not recommended.
What about drugs that induce CYP3A4, make it work faster?
Right. Inducers can do the opposite. They can decrease atorvastatin levels, potentially making it less effective. Rifampin, an antibiotic used for TB, is a key example. The interaction is complex, so sometimes taking them at the exact same time is recommended to manage it.
Okay. Any others? Specific antivirals?
Yes, with certain hepatitis C drugs like elbisvir/grazoprevir, the atorvastatin dose needs to be limited, usually to no more than 20 milligrams daily.
And even common things, food interactions.
Grapefruit juice. It's a classic CYP3A4 inhibitor, primarily in the gut wall. Drinking large amounts can increase atorvastatin levels. And even some over-the-counter things like antacids, specifically those containing magnesium and aluminum hydroxides like Mallox TC, can slightly decrease atorvastatin absorption.
It's a minefield. Really shows why telling your doctor and pharmacist everything you take, including supplements and juices, is so important.
Absolutely crucial.
Okay, let's shift focus to making the drug, manufacturing. You mentioned Pfizer improved the synthesis. Is it a simple process?
Oh, far from it. The chemical synthesis of atorvastatin calcium is actually quite complex. Over the years, many different synthetic routes have been published, reflecting ongoing efforts to make it more efficient and cost-effective.
Given how much of it is used worldwide, efficiency must be paramount.
Exactly. And the field is still evolving. There's research into using continuous manufacturing processes.
What's that?
Instead of making the drug in separate batches, it's a more modern approach where the different chemical steps flow continuously one after the other. It can potentially improve efficiency, quality control, and maybe even reduce costs further down the line.
Sounds like a smart direction for high-volume drugs. And quality control must be incredibly strict throughout.
Absolutely non-negotiable. Pharmaceutical manufacturing is tightly regulated. Process validation, quality checks on raw materials, in-process monitoring, testing the final product. Everything has to meet stringent standards set by agencies like the FDA to ensure safety, purity, and effectiveness in every single pill or dose.
Right. Which leads us neatly into the regulatory side. getting a drug like Lipitor approved, and navigating the world of generics. What's the basic process?
For a new brand name drug like Lipitor was, the company submits a new drug application, an NDA, to the FDA. It's a massive dossier with all the preclinical and clinical trial data showing it's safe and effective.
And for generics?
They file an abbreviated new drug application, or NNDA. They typically don't need to repeat all the big clinical trials. They primarily need to show their version is bioequivalent, meaning it gets absorbed into the body similarly to the brand name drug. But a key part of the NDA is dealing with patents.
Ah, yes, the patents. That's where things often get complicated and litigious.
Very often. A generic company wanting to launch before the brand patents expire usually files what's called a Paragraph V certification with their NDA.
What does that mean?
It's basically the generic company saying they believe the patent on the brand drug is either invalid or that their generic version won't infringe it. This almost always triggers a lawsuit from the brand company.
And atorvastatin definitely had its share of patent battle.
Oh, big time. Warner Lambert, which Pfizer later acquired, initially had the main patent on the atorvastatin molecule itself, the 893 patent, but the real fireworks started with a later patent.
Which one was that?
The 995 patent. This one covered a specific crystalline form of atorvastatin calcium, and it became hugely controversial.
Why? What was the issue?
There were allegations, which became central to legal challenges, about the biological activity data submitted to get that patent. The claim submitted suggested the pure active form was 10 times more active than a mixture of forms, but later analysis indicated the difference was much smaller, maybe closer to twofold.
That's a pretty big difference in reported activity. How did that play out?
It became a major point of contention in lawsuits challenging the 995 patent's validity. Eventually, Pfizer itself, during a re-examination of the patent, actually had to disavow the reliability of that specific piece of biological data to the U.S. Patent Office.
Wow. So that must have weakened their position on that patent.
It certainly complicated things, but Pfizer didn't stop there. As the original 893 patent expiry loomed, they also tried using process patents.
Patents on how the drug was made.
Exactly. Patents like the 740 and 511 covered specific methods for converting crystalline and atorvastatin back into an amorphous, non-crystalline form. They tried to argue in court that generic companies, like Ranbaxy, would inevitably infringe these process patents when making their versions.
Did that work?
Ultimately, no. The courts ruled against Pfizer on those process patent claims in the Ranbaxy litigation. They didn't provide the extended market lockup Pfizer was seeking.
Speaking of Ranbaxy, that legal fight was a really big deal for generic atorvastatin, wasn't it?
It was pivotal.
Yeah.
Ranbaxy was one of the first, if not the first, generic company to file an ANDA with that Paragraph V3 challenge against Pfizer's patents.
And being first to file matters.
Yes. It usually grants the generic company a valuable 180-day period of market exclusivity for their generic version once it's approved. So the stakes were incredibly high. There was intense litigation.
But it ended in a settlement, right? Which delayed the generic?
That's correct. Pfizer and Ranbaxy reached a settlement agreement. The outcome was that Ranbaxy agreed not to launch its generic atorvastatin in the U.S. until November 30, 2011. Without that deal, you can bet Ranbaxy would have pushed to get to market much, much sooner.
It bought Pfizer significant extra time for Lipitor's blockbuster sales. There was also that slightly unusual citizen petition Pfizer filed, right?
Yeah.
About the form of atorvastatin.
Yes, that was another tactic. Pfizer filed a petition with the FDA raising concerns because Ranbaxy's proposed generic used an amorphous form of atorvastatin, whereas Lipitor used a crystalline form.
What was their argument?
They were essentially questioning if the amorphous form would be as stable or behave the same way. However, the FDA denied Pfizer's petition.
On what grounds?
The FDA basically reiterated its standard position. A generic drug substance doesn't have to be the exact same physical form, like crystalline versus amorphous as the brand name, as long as the generic company proves bioequivalence and stability. So that route didn't block Ranbaxy either.
So despite a complex and hard-fought battle, generic atorvastatin did eventually arrive.
Yeah.
Okay, let's switch back to the patient experience. Safety and tolerability. What are the most common things people report?
Muscle pain or myalgia is definitely the most common side effect people associate with statins, including atorvastatin. For many, it's mild, but for some, it can be quite bothersome and lead them to stop the medication.
But there are more serious muscle issues too, though rare.
Yes. Myopathy, which is more significant muscle pain or weakness, often with elevated muscle enzyme levels, and the most severe form, rhabdomyolysis.
Rhabdo, that's the one that can affect the kidneys.
Correct. It involves extensive muscle breakdown, releasing substances that can damage the kidneys. It's rare, but serious. The risk is higher in people with kidney problems already, or when atorvastatin is taken with certain interacting drugs we discussed earlier.
What about other organs? The liver?
Liver enzyme elevations can occur. You might see rises in AST and ALT on blood tests. These are relatively common, often temporary, and frequently don't signify actual liver damage. But routine monitoring used to be standard practice, though guidelines have evolved. Serious liver failure is extremely rare, but has been reported.
And there's been talk about statins and diabetes risk.
Yes, that's another area of focus. Studies have shown a slightly increased risk of developing new onset type 2 diabetes, particularly with higher statin doses.
How do doctors weigh that risk against the benefits?
It's a risk-benefit calculation. For most people prescribed statins, especially those at high cardiovascular risk, the proven benefits in preventing heart attacks and strokes are generally considered to far outweigh the small increased risk of diabetes. But it's something to be aware of and monitor for.
Any groups who absolutely shouldn't take it?
Pregnant women. Atorvastatin is contraindicated in pregnancy. Cholesterol is essential for fetal development, so blocking its synthesis could potentially harm the fetus. It should be stopped if pregnancy occurs. Breastfeeding is also generally not advised, as the drug might pass into breast milk.
Okay. Any other side effects people might encounter? Things seen in trials?
Clinical trials have reported various other things: fatigue or malaise, digestive upset like nausea or diarrhea, joint pain, arthralgia, sometimes headache. Less common things like insomnia, dizziness, skin reactions can occur too.
So it comes back to good communication between doctor and patient.
Absolutely. Counseling patients on what to watch for, especially muscle symptoms, explaining the liver monitoring, the pregnancy issue, it's all vital.
Let's zoom out again. The economic side. Lipitor was famously the best-selling drug in the world for a long time. The market impact must have been huge.
Absolutely massive. The overall global market for statins and cholesterol-lowering drugs in general is enormous, and that's driven by the sheer prevalence of cardiovascular disease worldwide. The demand is consistently high.
And generics changed that market profoundly.
Completely. The arrival of generic atorvastatin dramatically lowered costs and massively increased patient access. It also put a spotlight on the importance of manufacturing the core ingredient, the atorvastatin API, or active pharmaceutical ingredient.
API production becomes a big business in itself.
It does. And you see strategic partnerships forming between the drug companies selling the finished pills and the specialized manufacturers making the API, all aimed at securing the supply chain and keeping costs manageable.
So economically, generics have been a huge win for healthcare systems and patients. What about the cultural side? Lipitor became a household name.
It really did. Statins in general, and Lipitor perhaps most prominently, definitely raised public awareness about cholesterol, risk factors, and heart disease prevention. But it also attracted scrutiny.
You're thinking of marketing campaigns.
Particularly the big Lipitor campaign featuring Dr. Robert Jarvik, the inventor of the artificial heart. The tagline was, "For me, there is no substitute."
Right. I remember that one. It caused quite a stir, didn't it?
It did. Questions were raised about whether Dr. Jarvik was actually a cardiologist or even took Lipitor himself regularly. The authenticity of some aspects, like him appearing to row crew when he didn't, was questioned.
What was the concern? It was misleading.
The concern, which led to things like a congressional inquiry into Pfizer's marketing, was that the campaign might imply that brand name Lipitor was uniquely necessary or superior to potentially equivalent and much cheaper generics, even after they became available.
So it fueled the debate about direct-to-consumer drug advertising.
Exactly. And the broader discussion about brand loyalty versus cost-effectiveness, especially for preventative medications, the "only Lipitor is Lipitor" message was clearly designed to combat the shift to generics.
Fascinating. So a drug with this incredible scientific backstory, complex mechanism, major legal dramas, and a huge societal footprint.
It really touches on so many aspects of medicine and society.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive on atorvastatin. Let's try to quickly recap the big points.
We started with the long history of cholesterol science leading to the first statins, Compactin and Levastatin.
Then Pfizer's development of atorvastatin, including improving how it was made. We talked about how it works inhibiting HMG-CoA reductase to lower LDL.
Right. We covered who it's for, high cholesterol, genetic conditions, risk reduction, and what the guidelines say. We looked at how the body handles it, pharmacokinetics, those crucial liver considerations, and the many potential drug interactions.
Plus, the manufacturing intricacies, the whole regulatory maze with NDAs, ANDAs, and those intense patent fights, especially with Ranbaxy.
Then, safety, muscle pain being common, the rare but serious rhabdo, liver effects, the diabetes link, and why it's a no-go in pregnancy.
And finally, its enormous economic impact, first as a blockbuster, then with generics, and its cultural influence, including that memorable Jarvik ad campaign and the debates it sparked.
And for you listening, it just highlights this whole complex journey a medication takes, right? From a lab idea to something millions rely on, constantly shaped by science, regulation, economics, and even marketing.
Definitely. So here's something to leave you thinking about. We have this incredibly effective drug, atorvastatin, now widely available as a low-cost generic. How do we strike the right balance? How do we ensure everyone who needs it can access it affordably while still making sure pharmaceutical companies have the incentive to innovate and develop the next generation of life-saving drugs?
And layered on top of that, what's the role of clear, honest, ethical communication from doctors, from companies, from regulators in making sure we all trust the medications we rely on?
It's a big question, touching on personal health, public policy, and the future of medicine. Something to ponder. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.